Chapter 25. Sobs shook her, and she bowed to them like a tree in a dry storm. Jerdy knelt beside her, waiting, with the patience born of experience, till his gust of misery should loosen fresh speech. As he at first imagined some physical shock, some peril of the crowded streets, since Lily was presumably on her way home from Carrie Fisher's. But she now saw that other nerve centers were smitten, and her mind trembled back from conjecture. Lily's sob ceased, and she lifted her head. There are bad girls in your slums. Tell me, do they ever pick themselves up? Ever forget, and feel as they did before? Lily, you mustn't speak so you're dreaming. Don't they always go from bad to worse? There's no turning back, your old self rejects you, and shuts you out. She rose, stretching her arms, as if in utter physical weariness. Go to bed, dear. You work hard, and get up early. I'll watch here by the fire, and you'll leave the light, and your door open. All I want, is to feel, that you are near me. She laid both hands on Jerdy's shoulders, with a smile, that was like sunrise on a sea strewn with wreckage. I can't leave you, Lily. Come and lie on my bed. Your hands are frozen, you must undress, and be made warm. Jerdy paused with sudden compunction. Be but Mrs. Peniston, it's past midnight. What will she think? She goes to bed. I have a latch key. It doesn't matter, I can't go back there. There's no need to. You shall stay here. But you must tell me where you have been. Listen, Lily, it will help you to speak. She regained Miss Bart's hands, and pressed them against her. Try to tell me, it will clear your poor head. Listen, you were dining at Carrie Fisher's. Jerdy paused and added with a flash of heroism, Colin Lawrence Selden went from here to find you. At the word, Lily's face melted from locked anguish to the open misery of a child. Her lips trembled and her gaze widened with tears. He went to find me? And I missed him. Oh, Jerdy, he tried to help me. He told me, he warned me long ago, he foresaw that I should grow hateful to myself. The name, as Jerdy saw with a clutch at the heart, had loosened the springs of self-pity in her friend's dry breast, and tear by tear Lily poured out the measure of her anguish. As he had dropped sideways in Jerdy's big armchair, her head buried where lately Selden's had leaned, in a beauty of abandonment that drove home to Jerdy's aching senses the inevitableness of her own defeat. Ah, it needed no deliberate purpose on Lily's part to rob her of her dream. To look on that prone loveliness was to see in it a natural force, to recognize that love and power belong to such as Lily, as renunciation and service are the lot of those they despoil. But if Selden's infatuation seemed a fatal necessity, the effect that his name produced shook Jerdy's steadfastness with a last pang. Men pass through such superhuman loves and outlive them. They are the probation subduing the heart to human joys. How gladly Jerdy would have welcomed the ministry of healing. How willingly have soothed the sufferer back to tolerance of life. But Lily's self-betrayal took this last hope from her. The mortal maid on the shore is helpless against the siren who loves her prey. Such victims are floated back dead from their adventure. Lily sprang up and caught her with strong hands. Gee, Jerdy, you know him, you understand him, tell me. If I went to him, if I told him everything, if I said, I am bad through and through, I want admiration, I want excitement, I want money, apostrophe, yes, money. That's my shame, Jerdy, and it's known, it's said of me, it's what men think of me. If I said it all to him, told him the whole story, said plainly, Colin, I've sunk lower than the lowest, for I've taken what they take, and not paid as they pay. Oh, Jerdy, you know him, you can speak for him. If I told him everything, would he loathe me? Or would he pity me, and understand me, and save me from loathing myself? Jerdy stood cold and passive. She knew the hour of her probation had come, and her poor heart beat wildly against its destiny. As a dark river sweeps by under a lightning flash, she saw her chance of happiness surge past under a flash of temptation. What prevented her from saying, Colin, he is like other men? She was not so sure of him, after all. but to do so would have been like blaspheming her love. She could not put him before herself in any light but the noblest. She must trust him to the height of her own passion. "Yes, I know him. He will help you," she said. And in a moment Lily's passion was weeping itself out against her breast. There was but one bed in the little flat, and the two girls lay down on it side by side, when Gertie had unlaced Lily's dress, and persuaded her to put her lips to the warm tea. The light extinguished, they lay still in the darkness, Gertie shrinking to the outer edge of the narrow couch, to avoid contact with her bedfellow. Knowing that Lily disliked to be caressed, as he had long ago learned to check her demonstrative impulses toward her friend. But tonight every fiber in her body shrank from Lily's nearness. It was torture to listen to her breathing, and feel the sheet stir with it. As Lily turned, and settled to complete her rest, a strand of her hair swept Gertie's cheek with its fragrance. Everything about her was warm and soft and scented. Even the stains of her grief became her as raindrops to the beaten rose. But as Gertie lay with arms drawn down her side, in the motionless narrowness of an effigy, she felt a stir of sobs from the breathing warmth beside her, and Lily flung out her hand, groped for her friend's, and held it fast. "Hold me, Gertie, hold me, or I shall think of things," she moaned, and Gertie silently slipped an arm under her, pillowing her head in its hollow as a mother makes a nest for a tossing child. In the warm hollow Lily lay still and her breathing grew low and regular. Her hand still clung to Gertie's as if to ward off evil dreams, but the hold of her fingers relaxed, her head sank deeper into its shelter, and Gertie felt that she slept. When Lily woke as he had the bed to herself, and the winter light was in the room, she sat up, bewildered by the strangeness of her surroundings. Then memory returned, and she looked about her with a shiver. In the cold slant of light reflected from the back wall of a neighboring building, she saw her evening dress and opera cloak lying in a tawdry heap on a chair. Finery laid off was as unappetizing as the remains of a feast, and it occurred to Lily that, at home, her maid's vigilance had always spared her the sight of such incongruities. Her body ached with fatigue, and with the constriction of her attitude in Gertie's bed. All through her troubled sleep as he had been conscious of having no space to toss in, and the long effort to remain motionless made her feel as if as he had spent her night in a train. This sense of physical discomfort was the first to assert itself. Then she perceived, beneath it, a corresponding mental prostration, a languor of horror more insufferable than the first rush of her disgust. The thought of having to wake every morning with this weight on her breast roused her tired mind to fresh effort. She must find some way out of the slough into which she had stumbled. It was not so much compunction as the dread of her morning thoughts that pressed on her the need of action. But she was unutterably tired. It was weariness to think connectedly. She lay back, looking about the poor slit of a room with a renewal of physical distaste. The outer air, penned between high buildings, brought no freshness through the window. Steam heat was beginning to sing in a coil of dingy pipes, and a smell of cooking penetrated the crack of the door. The door opened, and Gertie, dressed and hatted, entered with a cup of tea. Her face looked sallow and swollen in the dreary light, and her dull hair shaded imperceptibly into the tones of her skin. She glanced shyly at Lily, asking in an embarrassed tone how she felt. Lily answered with the same constraint, and raised herself up to drink the tea. "I must have been overtired last night. I think I had a nervous attack in the carriage," she said, as the drink brought clearness to her sluggish thoughts. "You were not well. I am so glad you came here," Gertie returned. "But how am I to get home? And Aunt Julia, she knows. I telephoned early, and your maid has brought your things. But won't you eat something? I scrambled the eggs myself." Lily could not eat, but the tea strengthened her to rise and dress under her maid's searching gaze. It was a relief to her that Gertie was obliged to hasten away. The two kissed silently, but without a trace of the previous night's emotion. Lily found Mrs. Peniston in a state of agitation, as he had sent for Grace Stepney and was taking the Digitalis. Lily breasted the storm of inquiries as best she could, explaining that as he had had an attack of faintness on her way back from Carrie Fisher's, that, fearing she would not have strength to reach home, as he had gone to Miss Farish's instead, but that a quiet night had restored her, and that as he had no need of a doctor. This was a relief to Mrs. Peniston, who could give herself up to her own symptoms, and Lily was advised to go and lie down, her aunt's panacea for all physical and moral disorders. In the solitude of her own room she was brought back to a sharp contemplation of facts. Her daylight view of them necessarily differed from the cloudy vision of the night. The winged furies were now prowling gossips who dropped in on each other for tea. But her fears seemed the uglier, thus shorn of their vagueness. And besides, as he had to act, not rave. For the first time she forced herself to reckon up the exact amount of her debt to Trina, and the result of this hateful computation was the discovery that as he had, in all, received $9,000 from him. The flimsy pretext on which it had been given, and received shriveled up in the blaze of her shame. She knew that not a penny of it was her own, and that to restore her self-respect she must at once repay the whole amount. The inability thus to solace her outraged feelings gave her a paralyzing sense of insignificance. She was realizing for the first time that a woman's dignity may cost more to keep up than her carriage, and that the maintenance of a moral attribute should be dependent on dollars and cents, made the world appear a more sordid place than as he had conceived it. After luncheon, when Grace Stepney's prying eyes had been removed, Lily asked for a word with her aunt. The two ladies went upstairs to the sitting room, where Mrs. Peniston seated herself in her black satin armchair tufted with yellow buttons, beside a beadwork table bearing a bronze box with a miniature of Beatrice Senkai in the lid. Lily felt for these objects the same distaste which the prisoner may entertain for the fittings of the courtroom. It was here that her aunt received her rare confidences, and the pink-eyed smirk of the turbaned Beatrice was associated in her mind with the gradual fading of the smile from Mrs. Peniston's lips. That lady's dread of a scene gave her an inexorableness which the greatest strength of character could not have produced, since it was independent of all considerations of right or wrong, and knowing this, Lily seldom ventured to assail it. As he had never felt less like making the attempt than on the present occasion, but as he had sought in vain for any other means of escape from an intolerable situation. Mrs. Peniston examined her critically. "Why, you're a bad color, Lily. This incessant rushing about is beginning to tell on you," she said. Miss Bart saw an opening. I don't think it's that, Aunt Julia. I've had worries," she replied. "Ah," said Mrs. Peniston, shutting her lips with the snap of a purse closing against a beggar. "I'm sorry to bother you with them," Lily continued, "but I really believe my faintness last night was brought on partly by anxious thoughts. I should have said Carrie Fisher's cook was enough to account for it. As he has a woman who was with Maria Melson in 1891, the spring of the year we went to Aix, and I remember dining there 2 days before we sailed, and feeling sure the coppers hadn't been scoured. I don't think I ate much. I can't eat or sleep." Lily paused, and then said abruptly, "The fact is, Aunt Julia, I owe some money." Mrs. Peniston's face clouded perceptibly, but did not express the astonishment her niece had expected. She was silent, and Lily was forced to continue, "I have been foolish, no doubt you have. Extremely foolish," Mrs. Peniston interposed. "I fail to see how anyone with your income, and no expenses not to mention the handsome presents I've always given you, oh, you've been most generous, Aunt Julia, I shall never forget your kindness. But perhaps you don't quite realize the expense a girl is put to nowadays." "I don't realize that you are put to any expense except for your clothes and your railway fares. I expect you to be handsomely dressed, but I paid Celeste's bill for you last October." Lily hesitated. Her aunt's implacable memory had never been more inconvenient. Why, you were as kind as possible, but I have had to get a few things since. What kind of things? Clothes? How much have you spent? Let me see the bill. I dare say the woman is swindling you. Oh, no, I think not. Clothes have grown so frightfully expensive, and one needs so many different kinds, with country visits, and golf and skating, and Aiken and tuxedo. Let me see the bill, Mrs. Peniston repeated. Lily hesitated again. In the first place, me. Celeste had not yet sent in her account, and secondly, the amount it represented was only a fraction of the sum that Lily needed. S.E. hasn't sent in the bill for my winter things, but I know it's large, and there are one or two other things. I've been careless and imprudent. I'm frightened to think of what I owe. She raised the troubled loveliness of her face to Mrs. Peniston, vainly hoping that a sight so moving to the other sex might not be without effect upon her own. But the effect produced was that of making Mrs. Peniston shrink back apprehensively. Really, Lily, you are old enough to manage your own affairs, and after frightening me to death by your performance of last night, you might at least choose a better time to worry me with such matters. Mrs. Peniston glanced at the clock and swallowed a tablet of digitalis. If you owe Celeste another 1,000, she may send me her account, she added, as though to end the discussion at any cost. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.